Welcome to Covenant Presbyterian Church in West Des Moines, Iowa. This educational offering is part of our mission to bless our neighbors to the glory of God. We hope it blesses you. I want to give you a welcome back to Contemporary Issues in this strange new world that we live in. I want to start with a program announcement. And the program announcement is about what we're doing next month. And next month starts next Monday. It actually starts on Thursday, but who's counting? So next month for Contemporary Issues, I want to invite you all to join the 21-day equity challenge from the United Way. And you may have seen this promoted in other circles that you travel in. So if you've already signed up, you've already done your job. The 21-day equity challenge is an intensive course in how inequity and racism affect our life and our community, kind of through the lens of the way that United Way engages with the community around us. So I'm gonna throw you the link here that you can sign right up if you like. So this is gonna show up in the chat. The way that this works is when you sign up, you will get an email every weekday. So 21 days is 21 weekdays beginning on October the 5th. You'll get an email every weekday with articles to read, videos to watch, podcasts to listen to. And each day is on a specific theme, on a specific topic. So you will have each day material to sort of take in and learn about how inequity and racism affect our life and our community. And you'll be doing this along with however many thousand of other people in central Iowa. But it'll be our dozen or so, however many convene with us on Monday evenings to kind of have the direct conversations and discussion of those. Or if you're doing this through a separate group as well, you'll get two different discussion groups. So that's double the fun, right? I'm gonna put this link in the chat one more time, because if you were gone when the chat came through, you don't get it. So this is to sign up for the United Way Equity Challenge. And it also, that website has more information as well. This link will also be in the Covenant Corner tomorrow. If you want to just remember in your brain, I have to do the thing at the Contemporary Issues announcement in the corner tomorrow. So that's where we're going to start next week. And that's why when I said I knew where we were going, but I hadn't planned where we were going this week yet, that's what I meant. That I knew where we were going to end up, but we had this week to work with. So just a recap. Last week was the International Day of Peace, that 24 hours when we try worldwide to have violence not prevent the things that need to happen in the world. So as we talked about a day of peace, you said, hey, how can we shape peace with our neighbors right here where we are, and how do we do that during COVID? There's no question that COVID makes everything harder, right? Especially things that involve connecting with people, because all of a sudden now we are connecting through these screens, and so are you and your neighbors, and so are you and your grandkids, and and just everybody is in this sort of odd, this odd way of connecting with each other. But that's not impossible, right? Because we are keeping in contact with our family, you know, across town or across the state or across the country. It all kind of feels the same now, right? And, you know, we're connecting with our neighbors in San Ysidro. And as soon as Deb's internet comes back, she'll be back on. And so we were talking right before we started about kind of next steps in the Our Sister Parish relationship. And so these relationships keep happening, right? Some of the things that made it hard for us to connect with our neighbors during normal times are still preventing us from connecting with our neighbors, right? Because we're still busy. We still have kind of the number of relationship slots in our social life that we can handle. And so, you know, making room for a new connection, especially a new connection that may be challenging, right? Those slots we don't necessarily refill immediately because we've got enough else to do. You know, we still, when we talk about shaping peace, especially, we're talking about, you know, differences of, you know, religious differences or racial differences or economic differences or political differences. And then of course, there's always just knowing where to start, right? How do we begin a conversation with someone? So I want to actually start tonight with knowing where to start, because the piece of how do we figure out to relate with people, we actually are all solving these problems already with the people we care enough about to solve those problems, right? So our extended family who don't live in the same house with us, we are solving problems about how do we communicate with them, how do we connect with them. What I want to get sort of back to is, why do we want to do this? Why do we want to have these altruistic relationships with our neighbors? Why do we want to connect with people in a way that benefits them and not just ourselves? So I'm going to share a video with us by Robert Wright. Robert Wright is a journalist and a philosopher. He's written about religion and cooperation and works on just kind of making sense of the world through those lenses. And today he's going to talk about evolutionary biology. He's going to talk about game theory, and he's going to talk about the golden rule. So evolutionary biology is how did these organisms that are on the screen with me, whether all these primates up here or Pam's cat, how these organisms got the way that we are. And we got the way that we are because the way that we are solved some problems that we had experienced before. Game theory is basically talking about how do we cooperate with each other, how do we not cooperate with each other, and how do we make decisions about when we're cooperating and when we're not. And the golden rule, I'm guessing you all know, right? Who's got the golden rule for me? Oh, you people, you're terrible Presbyterians. Somebody tell me the golden rule.
Do unto others. I was trying to unmute. Thank you.
Yes, do unto others. Do unto others what? Before they do unto you, right?
Yeah.
As you would have them say it again, Mary.
Do unto others as you would have them do unto you.
Yes.
Well, I came out of Marshall County, and it was who has the gold makes the rules, but maybe that's unique from Marshall County.
Yeah, we've got all kinds of like cynical takes on the golden rule, don't we? So yeah, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. So we get that, we know that, we like that rule. We also, like those folks from Marshall County, don't always live by that golden rule, right? And there are, game theory is kind of talking about the contexts, when do we live by the golden rule and when don't we live by the golden rule? I love Robert Wright. He's this sort of sour looking journalist type, who says like the most wonderful uplifting things in like the least uplifting way. So, I really enjoy him for that. And so he's going to talk about how, there's hope that, we will, continue moving toward having the compassion to live by the golden rule. So he's going to talk about how kind of the group that is like entitled to our altruism, expands as the world gets more complicated. Somebody tell me what the word altruism means. This is not one that makes you good or bad Presbyterians, but
willing to give unconditionally.
Yeah, willing to give unconditionally. That is willing to do something that benefits someone else when it does not benefit you, and especially when it comes at a cost to you. Although the cost, I think, is. If we focus on the cost to ourselves, we're likely to weasel out of either being altruistic or believing that we are altruistic, depending on how we think about that. But yeah, doing something for someone else that is not directly beneficial to us, which is sort of that's the thing that the golden rule makes possible, right? The golden rule, you know, doing for someone else what you wish they would do to you, that's not, you know, waiting for them to do something good. It is going out and doing it first. That's altruism. Altruism is a great big topic in evolutionary biology. So that's where that's going to come in. So we're gonna listen to this idea that. As life gets more interconnected, our in-group actually expands, and so we can be more altruistic. And then we'll talk about how we could expand the group with whom we have those interdependent relationships. So, any questions before I jump us over to Robert Wright?
I just spelled his last name.
Wright. All right, let's get him here. And okay, here is Robert Wright.
I'm going to talk about compassion and the golden rule from a secular perspective, and even from a kind of scientific perspective. I'm going to try to give you a little bit of a natural history of compassion and the golden rule. So I'm going to be sometimes using kind of clinical language, and so it's not going to sound as warm and fuzzy maybe as your average compassion talk. I want to warn you about that. So I do want to say at the outset that I think, you know, compassion's great. The golden rule is great. I'm a big supporter of both. And I think it's great that the religions of the world, the leaders of the religions of the world, are affirming compassion and the golden rule as fundamental principles that are integral to their faiths. At the same time, I think religions don't deserve all the credit. I think nature kind of gave them a helping hand here. I'm going to going to argue tonight that compassion and the golden rule are, in a certain sense, built into human nature. Okay, but I'm also going to argue that once you understand the sense in which they are built into human nature, then you realize that just affirming compassion and affirming the golden rule is really not enough. There's a lot of work to be done after that. Okay. So quick natural history of first compassion. In the beginning, there was compassion, not just when human beings first showed up, but actually even before that. I think it's probably the case that in the human evolutionary lineage, even before there were Homo sapiens, feelings like compassion and love and sympathy had earned their way kind of into the gene pool. And biologists have a pretty clear idea of how this first happened. It happened through a principle known as kin selection. And the basic idea of kin selection is that if an animal feels compassion for a close relative, and this compassion leads the animal to help the relative, then in the end, the compassion actually winds up helping the genes underlying the compassion itself. So from a biologist's point of view, compassion is actually a gene's way of helping itself, okay? So I warned you this was not going to be very warm and fuzzy, okay? I'll get there. I hope to get a little fuzzier. To me, this doesn't bother me so much, that the underlying Darwinian rationale of compassion is kind of self-serving at the genetic level. Actually, I think what the bad news is about kin selection is just that it means that this kind of compassion is naturally deployed only within the family. That's the bad news. The good news is compassion is natural. The bad news is that this kin-selected compassion is naturally confined to the family. Now, there's more good news that came along later in evolution, a second kind of evolutionary logic. Biologists call that reciprocal altruism. Okay, and there the basic idea is that compassion leads you to do good things for people who then will return the favor. Again, you know, I know this is not as inspiring a notion of compassion as you may have heard in the past, but from a biologist's point of view, this reciprocal altruism kind of compassion, it is ultimately self-serving too. It's not that people think that when they feel the compassion. It's not consciously self-serving, but to a biologist, that's the logic. And so you wind up most easily extending compassion to friends and allies. I'm sure a lot of you, if a close friend has something really terrible happen to them, you feel really bad. But if you read in the newspaper that something really horrible happened to somebody you've never heard of, you can probably live with that. Okay, that's human nature. So it's another good news, bad news story. It's good that compassion was extended beyond the family by this kind of evolutionary logic. The bad news is this doesn't bring us universal compassion by itself. Okay, so there's still work to be done. Now, there's one other result of this dynamic called reciprocal altruism, which I think is kind of good news, which is that the way this has played out in the human species, okay, it has given people a kind of intuitive appreciation of the golden rule, okay? I don't quite mean that the golden rule itself is written in our genes, but you can go to a hunter-gatherer society that has had no exposure to any of the great religious traditions, no exposure to ethical philosophy, and you'll find, if you spend time with these people, that basically they believe that one good turn deserves another, and that bad deeds should be punished. And evolutionary psychologists think that these intuitions have a basis in the genes. So they do understand that if you want to be treated well, you treat other people well, and it's good to treat other people well. That's close to being a kind of built-in intuition. So that's good news. Now, if you've been paying attention, you probably are anticipating that there's bad news here, okay? That we still aren't to universal love. And it's true, because although an appreciation of the golden rule is natural, it's also natural to kind of carve out exceptions to the golden rule, okay? I mean, for example, none of us probably want to go to prison, but we all think that there are some people who should go to prison, right? So we think we should treat them differently than we would want to be treated. Now, we have a rationale for that. We say they did these bad things that make it just that they should go to prison. None of us really extends the golden rule in truly diffuse and universal fashion. We have the capacity to carve out exceptions, put people in a special category. And the problem is that although in the case of sending people to prison, you have this impartial judiciary determining, you know, who gets excluded from the Golden Rule, that, you know, in everyday life, the way we all make these decisions about who we're not going to extend the Golden Rule to, we use a much kind of rougher and readier formula. And basically, it's just like, if you're my enemy, if you're my rival, okay, if you're not my friend, if you're not in my family, I'm much less inclined to apply the Golden Rule to you, okay? We all kind of do that. And you see it all over the world. You know, you see it in the Middle East. People who from Gaza are firing missiles at Israel, they wouldn't want to have missiles fired at them, but they say, well, but the Israelis or some of them have done things that put them in a special category. The Israelis would not want to have an economic blockade imposed on them, but they imposed one on Gaza, and they would say, well, the Palestinians or some of them have brought this on themselves. So it's these exclusions to the Golden Rule that amount to a lot of the world's trouble. And so and it's natural to do that. So the fact that the Golden Rule is in some sense built into us is not by itself going to bring us universal love. It's not going to save the world. Now, there's one piece of good news I have that may save the world, okay? Are you on the edges of your seats here? Good, because before I tell you about that good news, I'm going to have to take a little excursion through some academic terrain. So I hope I've got your attention with this promise of good news that may save the world. It's this non-zero-sumness stuff you just heard a little bit about. It's just a quick introduction to game theory. This won't hurt, okay? It's about zero-sum and non-zero-sum games. If you ask, what kind of situation is conducive to people becoming friends and allies? The technical answer is a non-zero-sum situation. And if you ask what kind of situation is conducive to people defining people as enemies, it's kind of a zero-sum situation. Okay, so what do those terms mean? Basically, a zero-sum game is the kind you're used to in sports where there's a winner and a loser, so their fortunes add up to zero, okay? So in tennis, every point is either good for you and bad for the other person or good for them, bad for you. Either way, your fortunes add up to zero. That's a zero-sum game. Now, if you're playing doubles, then the person on your side of the net is in a non-zero-sum relationship with you because every point is either good for both of you, positive, win-win, or bad for both of you, it's lose-lose. Okay, that's a non-zero-sum game. And in real life, there are lots of non-zero-sum games. In the realm of economics, say, if you buy something, that means you'd rather have the merchandise than the money. But the merchant would rather have the money than the merchandise. You both feel you won, okay? In a war, two allies are playing a non-zero-sum game. It's going to either be win-win or lose-lose for them. So there are lots of non-zero-sum games in real life. And you could basically reformulate what I said earlier about how compassion is deployed and the Golden Rule is deployed by just saying, well, compassion most naturally flows along non-zero-sum channels where people perceive themselves as being in potentially a win-win situation with someone, their friends, their allies. The deployment of the Golden Rule most naturally happens along these non-zero-sum channels. So kind of webs of non-zero-sumness are where you would expect, you know, compassion and the Golden Rule to kind of work their magic. With zero-sum channels, you would expect something else. Okay. So now you're ready for the good news that I said might save the world. And now I can admit that it might not, too, now that I've held your attention for 3 minutes of technical stuff. But it may. And the good news is that history has naturally expanded these webs of non-zero-sumness, okay? These webs that can be these channels for compassion. You can go back all the way to the Stone Age, and I think from, you know, technological evolution, roads, the wheel, writing, a lot of transportation and communication technologies have just inexorably made it so that more people can be in more non-zero-sum relationships with more and more people at greater and greater distances. Okay, that's kind of the story of civilization. It's why social organization has grown from the hunter-gatherer village to the ancient state, the empire. Now here we are in a globalized world. And the story of globalization is largely a story of non-zero-sumness. Okay, you've probably heard the term interdependence applied to the modern world. Well, that's just another term for non-zero-sum. If your fortunes are interdependent with somebody, then you live in a non-zero-sum relationship with them. And you see this all the time in the modern world. You saw it with the recent economic crash where, you know, bad things happen in the economy, bad for everybody, good thing, you know, for much of the world, good things happen, it's good for much of the world. And, you know, I'm happy to say I think there's really evidence that this non-zero-sum kind of connection can expand the moral compass. I mean, if you look at the American attitudes toward Japanese during World War II, look at the depictions of Japanese in the American media as just about subhuman, and look at the fact that we dropped atomic bombs really without giving it much of a thought. And you compare that to the attitude now, I think part of that is due to a kind of economic interdependence. Any form of interdependence, non-zero-sum relationship, forces you to acknowledge the humanity of people. So I think that's good. And the world is full of non-zero-sum dynamics. Environmental problems, in many ways, put us all in the same boat. And there are non-zero-sum relationships that maybe people aren't aware of, okay? So, for example, probably a lot of American Christians don't think of themselves as being in a non-zero-sum relationship with Muslims halfway around the world, but they really are. Because if these Muslims become happier and happier with their place in the world and feel that they have a place in it, that's good for Americans because there will be fewer terrorists to threaten American security. If they get less and less happy, that will be bad for Americans, okay? So there's plenty of non-zero-sumness. And so the question is, if there's so much non-zero-sumness, why has the world not yet been suffused in love, peace, and understanding? The answer's complicated. It's the occasion for a whole nother talk, maybe. But certainly, a couple of things are that, first of all, there are a lot of zero-sum situations in the world. And also, you know, sometimes, again, people don't recognize the non-zero-sum dynamics in the world. And I think in both of these areas, you know, I think politicians can play a role. This isn't only about religion. I think politicians can help foster non-zero-sum relationships. You know, economic engagement is generally better than blockades and so on, I think, in this regard. And politicians can be aware and should be aware that when people around the world are looking at them, are looking at their nation, okay, and picking up their cues for whether they are in a zero-sum or a non-zero-sum relationship with a nation like, say, America or any other nation, human psychology is such that they use cues like, you know, do we feel we're being respected? Because, you know, historically, if you're not being respected, it's probably not, you're probably not going to wind up in a non-zero-sum, mutually profitable relationship with people. So we need to be aware of what kind of signals we're sending out. And some of this again is in the realm of kind of political work. If there's one thing I could encourage everyone to do, politicians, religious leaders, and us, it would be what I call expanding the moral imagination. Okay, that is to say, your ability to put yourself in the shoes of people in very different circumstances. This is not the same as compassion, but it's conducive to compassion. It opens the channels for compassion. And I'm afraid here we have another good news, bad news story, which is that the moral imagination is part of human nature. That's good. But again, we tend to deploy it selectively. Okay? Once we define somebody as an enemy, we have trouble putting ourselves in their shoes, just naturally. So if you want to take a particularly hard case, say for an American, somebody in Iran who's burning an American flag, say, and you see them on TV, well, the average American is going to kind of resist the moral exercise of putting themselves in that person's head and is going to resist the idea that they have much in common with that person. And if you tell them, well, they think that America disrespects them and even wants to dominate them and they hate America. Has there ever been somebody who disrespected you so much that you kind of hated them briefly? You know, they'll resist that comparison, and that's natural, that's human. And similarly, the person in Iran, when you try to humanize somebody in America who said Islam is evil, they'll have trouble with that, okay? So it's a very difficult thing to get people to expand the moral imagination to a place it doesn't naturally go. I think it's worth the trouble because, you know, again, it just helps us understand, if you want to reduce the number of people who are burning flags, helps to understand what makes them do it. And I think it's good moral exercise. I would say here again is where religious leaders come in, because religious leaders are good at reframing issues for people, you know, harnessing the emotional centers of the brain to get people to alter their awareness and just reframe the way they think. You know, I mean, religious leaders are kind of in the inspiration business. It's their great calling right now to get people all around the world better at expanding their moral imaginations, appreciating that in so many ways they're in the same boat. I would just sum up the way things look, at least from this secular perspective, in, as far as compassion and the golden rule go, by saying that it's good news that compassion and the golden rule are in some sense built in to human nature. It's unfortunate that they tend to be selectively deployed, and it's going to take real work to change that, but nobody ever said that doing God's work was going to be easy. Thanks.
Nobody ever said that doing God's work was going to be easy. So we're going to get in a minute to why did I choose this particular talk to talk about shaping peace with our neighbors in a time of COVID. And of course, this was this talk was given in 2009 when it would be hard to describe how much different the world was, right? But first, I want to make sure that we heard things correctly in there. So, can somebody tell me what a zero-sum game versus a non-zero-sum game is? These things aren't always games, but he used sports examples to talk about them, so that helped.
Zero sum is that somebody wins and somebody loses, and non-zero is that everybody wins or everybody loses. They're all the same.
Essentially, yeah. Yeah. So if you're in a non-zero sum relationship, it is possible for you and the other person to both win or both lose. And they get a lot more complicated than, you know, you're on the same doubles team, obviously, right? But the idea being that that a non-zero-sum relationship allows for everyone to do better at the same time, and then he started with this evolutionary biology piece talking about kin selection, which is even before sort of human social relationships come about. But, you know, if I help my biological brother raise his children so that they can grow up big and strong and have children of their own, half of my genes or a quarter of my genes in those mixtures are benefiting, right? And so that's kind of the evolutionary route for this altruism that is always kind of in this relationship. So when we move into this reciprocal altruism, you know, I'm gonna help out, you know, John with a project that he's working on, even though that doesn't directly benefit me, because I know that down the road, John, with whom I continue to have a relationship, he will help me with something else. And so this works in a group that we can recognize as like us. That works so long as we are in a web of non-zero sumness, right? And it's those people that we don't picture ourselves to be in that reciprocal relationship with that we tend to quit applying the golden rule. And we've got all kinds of structures socially for doing that. Okay, so you asked about how do I shape peace with my neighbors, and I showed you a video about altruism. Why did I do that? What does this altruism stuff and these webs of non-zero-sumness, what does that have to do with your relationships with your neighbors?
Things work out better and more easily if everybody benefits.
Things work out better and more easily if everybody benefits.
Altruism has the feel of one-sidedness. And I've kept thinking through all of this that we haven't talked about agape or judgmentalism. But somewhere in there, I think I'm weaving that in too.
Yeah, so agape or judgmentalism. Yeah. So tell us what you mean when you say agape. You don't have to get it right.
Love without expectation of return or even thought of return.
Love without expectation of return. Yeah. And what's that have to do with judgmentalism?
Many of the situations that he cited, there was a judgment first. Is this person my kin in a non-zero-sum relationship with me in my web? And I didn't hear him talking about giving the love unequivocally, non-judgmentally.
Yeah, so to extend that that altruism, extend that agape to those that we don't have that reciprocal relationship with, or the people that we have set on the other side of that reciprocal relationship. So he talked about the ways that we set people on the outside of that, right? Either they're just not part of our immediate sort of tribe, and I'm trying to use the word tribe there neutrally. You know, that if everybody in my village depends on each other and none of us depend on the people in the other village, those people aren't deserving of my compassion in the way that people in my village are. I may have to rationalize myself to that, but that's going to be where I start. Right, because I've got that you're talking about judgment in the sense of discriminating between people who belong to me and people who don't belong to me.
I mean it more in the sense of making a judgment about the, I might say, moral worth of the other person.
Yeah, and so the. The first example that he talked about, and it sort of, you know, how we draw these lines between the people who should get the golden rule and people who shouldn't, was people that we think should be in prison, right? Society, right? We don't all have to agree on who should be in prison, but we as a society have a structure that has a judge in the middle of it, right? His or her whole job is to, sort of referee the process by which we decide whether someone should be excluded from compassion. Like, none of us would want ourselves to be in prison. He also, and I think, John, you may have been bouncing in and out for this. So if this sounds unfamiliar, it happened while you were.
I've been here for most of it, returning. But I still have that occasional bandwidth program or whatever it is. But I think I've heard most of it.
So he brought up the example of, so you're an American and you see an image of someone in Iran burning an American flag and saying death to America. Based on your sort of reflexive identity as an American, you're going to tend to see that person as outside my group and a threat or a danger or not worthy of the same level of relationship and compassion, right?
And that's what we're trying to get past.
Exactly. So what we're trying to get past, and what Robert Wright invites us to do is to expand these webs of non-zero sumness. Where do you have sort of a living non-zero sum relationship with your neighbors? Let's get like really close, like your eight neighbors. Where do you have a non-zero sum relationship with those neighbors?
Some of us tend to shovel each other's sidewalks.
Shoveling randomly, each other's sidewalks.
Yeah, randomly without expectation that it'll be returned. It often is, but mm-hmm. If I do my neighbors, I don't expect them to bring me cookies or right. to do my sidewalks.
They are taking out the trash for somebody that's not able to do that. They're just...
Yeah. Okay. So the thing where I shovel my neighbor's sidewalk, sometimes they'll shovel mine later. I can see, like, I can do the math really quickly on how that's non-zero sum, right? Like, I have a morning when I've got more time available and I go shovel their walk. Later on some other morning when I don't have as much time available, they might shovel mine.
Or they might not.
Right. Or they might not.
And that's my point.
Right.
Without expectation.
Right. But they might not on any given occasion. Right. Pam, your example of, you know, you take out the trash for somebody who just can't. How is that non-zero sum?
Well, I was thinking about a neighbor across the street who's kind of physically disabled, so I've helped her with that. But doing that enables me to know her better, or even the people in the neighborhood, if we talk to each other about what's going on with other people. I mean, it helps us reach out to each other, especially if we feel guilty because we don't have time to individually contact all of them. And that's another thing about this altruism. I mean, you can, you know, feel compassion for a lot of people, but it takes a lot of time to reach out to as many people as you'd like to.
Yeah, this stuff takes time. And so actually part of the way that you get paid for taking out the neighbor's trash is that she's got time to sort of maintain this network of relationships. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And sort of she can bring the neighborhood gossip to you. Uh-huh. And gossip like is not necessarily a bad thing, right?
Right.
Yeah. Because gossip is the way that I find out that so-and-so three doors down that I don't spend a lot of time interacting uh-huh. with, you know, fell and broke her hip and is having mm-hmm. trouble getting yeah. around and cooking. And, you know, I could either run her to an appointment or take her a casserole or both.
Yeah.
And so gossip is also a, you know, like everything, it is both blessed and holy, and the other stuff as well. So what you've got there, Pam, is a relationship where you are doing something to benefit her because you've got the time and capacity for it, and she is doing something that benefits you because she has the time and capacity for keeping up on what's going on mm-hmm. in the neighborhood.
Yeah.
That's perfect. That's a great example of a non-zero sum relationship.
So we have a neighbor that puts their garbage and recycling and lawn waste container out every week. And they are so organized and so on top of it that the entire neighborhood, when it's time to take our garbage out, we look at their house to see if it's a recycling week. And is that, I mean, wouldn't that be like, we're benefiting from them. They don't have to do anything different than what they're already doing, but we're gaining from them. So it's kind of the opposite, but still an example.
Yeah.
I'm thinking of a situation that randomly comes to mind where I was visiting a friend and her dog, which is ordinarily an indoor dog and very much under control, suddenly decided it needed to take a run around the house. And neither my friend nor I was in any way able to catch up with this dog. It was a healthy dog. And the lady from down the street and a block over just came and helped. I don't think there was any expectation of anything there. I suppose remotely I might have figured, well, sometime maybe I can help her, but nobody thought about that. I think that's beyond this calculating the non-zero sum web, but I can't quite say that how that enters in. We also haven't used the word empathy.
In the case of the runaway dog, the woman helping to corral it may have been thinking, if the dog is running loose, it could get hit by a car or hurt, and she had compassion for the dog. Let's get this fellow under control and safe.
Yeah, so there's the empathy that we have is not always sort of clearly identified, right? This is part of how, you know, this is part of how these reciprocal relationships end up working, is that the neighbor down the street who goes to the trouble of running to catch the dog doesn't have to think about, you know, is this, you know, am I going to get something back from this? The cynical evolutionary biology approach to thinking about it says, I have identified dogs in my neighborhood and their owners as part of my in-group. Right? So dogs in my neighborhood and their owners are sort of reflexively going to get my compassion. They're reflexively going to get my, oh, I would hate it if my dog was out, I'll go save this one. There is, as you know, as John's bringing us back to sort of more kind of specifically Christian language, when we use a word like compassion or empathy, then we're moving into that, excuse me, we are moving into that, how would I feel if I was in that place? Part of Robert Wright's point is that we more naturally feel compassion for others who are in our group. We are more likely to respond that way to others who are in our group. Jesus also worked very hard at telling us to also respond that way specifically to those who are outside our group, and specifically to those who have placed us outside their group. Jesus, cites a verse from the Torah and sort of a traditional interpretation that had glommed onto it. The verse is "Love your neighbor as yourself," and then the interpretation that gets glommed onto it is "Love your neighbor and hate your enemy." So this is a group of people defining who belongs to them and who doesn't. Christians are great at this. So this is not a Christians versus Jews question. But Jesus says, okay, you've heard it said, love your neighbors and hate your enemies. But I tell you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you and blah, 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 blah. So he's like specifically turning us toward our enemies in compassion, which is what Wright was talking about when he said expanding, expanding our moral imagination. That's when he used the example of the person burning the flag and chanting death to America. He's saying, you know, completely understand why you might have a knee-jerk reaction against that person. And then think about why they would be saying that. Like, use some empathy. You know, imagine yourself into their shoes, which that takes work. Part of what I think Wright is doing is he's saying it doesn't have to take as much work. And I heard him in a different context expand on the, he cited the relationship between Americans and Japanese. And the, you know, we spent the 40s at war with Japan and dropping atomic bombs on them. And it was, you know, we had this sort of cognitive framework for they're not us. And he said, this is another context where he expanded on this, this idea, but he said, it's really hard nowadays to hate Japan because they built my minivan. And it's really hard to hate someone who built your minivan, right? You know, there are all kinds of ways that we still sort of, you know, we have this gradient of who's close to me and who's not. But these relationships where we actually depend on each other, Wright is saying that those are the relationships where we will figure out a way to show compassion to our neighbor. And there I want to come back to the eight neighbors, you know, the ones who live on either side and across the street and at the diagonals from them. And how do you actually depend on your neighbors? John and Pam both pointed to a couple of those ways that we depend on our neighbors. You know, we shovel their walk, they shovel our walk. We take out their trash, they keep up on the gossip for us. So those are ways that we are interdependent with some of our neighbors. We talked last winter, we were talking about neighbors and chickens. And I mentioned our neighbor across the street who gives us eggs. Man, you know, we also, you know, we can purchase eggs at the grocery store, but, you know, when he brings us over eggs and we take him over watermelon, you know, we're practicing some of that interdependence, right?
We occasionally have shoveled our neighbor to the south's walk, although he has a snowblower and he's in better condition than we are. He, in some sort of just world, he ought to be doing yours. But he did unexpectedly mow our front lawn, which was a complete surprise. In fact, we didn't even know who had done it. We thought it was perhaps other neighbors with whom we have a closer relationship. But he finally said, well, I just don't mind doing it, but if you want a reason, you didn't call the police when I had that loud party.
There you go.
So there's a way... We are interdependent. I never would have thought of that, but that I suppose is right. Or I might expect that if my neighbors saw the house on fire, even if they don't know me, even if they hate me, they would at least call the fire department.
We have a young couple that lives next to us, and right as she's got a 6-year-old and a 3-year-old, and when she was pregnant with a 3-year-old, her mother and her father passed away from major health issues, but quick ones. Like within a few months of knowledge that they had any kind of cancer, they were gone. And it was crushing to her. She was very close to both of her parents. And we came up with the idea that there's three pretty independent women living right near them. Let's be mom. So we started talking to her more than we had previously. We became aunts to her three kids. Now we're Aunt Deb and Aunt Dana and Aunt Jo. And we babysat the baby when she was a newborn and still jump in and babysit here and there as needed. They swim in my pool. He sometimes cuts grass for us if we get behind. One of the other neighbors, one of the aunts' husband passed away a few months ago. And that dad of the young couple has been cutting her grass for her. So she just has one less thing to think about as she transitions into being alone. And there's been so many give and take positives out of that simple, she lost her mom. We're the same age as her mom. Let's jump in and be supportive of her. And it's been a really wonderful relationship between all three families that was never expected and wasn't why we did it, but it's been pretty awesome. I read a quote today that was, it's not a quote, it's just a saying that somebody came up with, and it was, peace is not the absence of trouble, but the presence of Christ. And I think maybe more easily than some groups, we at Covenant anyway, I don't know if I want to say Christians in general, but we at Covenant, we wake up in the morning thinking about Christ, and it kind of gets our day started with the daily word and the different devotional that many of us use, talking to each other, joining classes like this. We're constantly putting God at the forefront, and that tends to help us understand that it's not a world without trouble. There's lots of trouble, but we can find peace because we have Christ. But that was kind of neat for tonight.
Deb, will you say that again? Peace is?
Peace is not the absence of trouble, but the presence of Christ. It came off a website, and Nathan, I think I shared this with you last winter, early spring, Women of Welcome. And they made a video where they went down to Mexico and tried to get to know the immigrants that were trying to come into the U.S. and to see what was happening on the border. And it was a pretty neat, quick little video, but they have a Bible study that you can get by email called In Pursuit of Peace. And they're looking at a lot of the things that we've been talking about tonight. I signed up to get it, but I'd be glad to share that email with you if you want to take a look at this organization or this group. They've got a lot of neat little videos and emails that talk about equity and why we're all deserving of what many of us have in a life of privilege, but a life of peace.
Way back in college, when I started thinking about such issues, one of the common phrases one would hear is that peace is not the absence of war. And I think a lot of people tend to look at peace that way. We're at peace with Russia because we're not at war with them. I think that's the mindset. I try to go well beyond that and think of, well, I'll just say that. I try to go well beyond that to the point where I might be being peaceful in ways that I don't recognize and that nobody else will recognize either. But, and maybe that's agape. Somebody who speaks Greek in this group might tend to know that.
So, and if I'm following you right, it's peace as something that, you know, it's not just that we're not going to be in conflict, because conflict can happen. I'm just going to assume that I'm getting John right now. But peace sort of at kind of the underlying level that would help us know, well, I know why we're not fighting, right? I know why we wouldn't be at war, and not just because war is bad, right? Because nobody has ever gone to war because they thought that war was bad, right? We only go to war when we've decided that's the least bad option. Part of what I like about kind of talking about this interdependency thing is that having relationships with our neighbors is one of those things that we can kind of sentimentalize. You know, I have a good relationship with my neighbors if I'm happy when I see them. You probably all have had relationships with neighbors where you're not actually all that happy when you see them. You may have the, you may have relationships with family members where you're not all that happy with when you see them. We have a tendency to kind of emotionalize the things that we want. And that kind of reduces working well together with feeling good about each other. What I like about the sort of the interdependency thing, and I think this is related to the, not just being at a lower level of conflict or keeping each other at a distance so we're not at war, really kind of making sustainable peace. Sustainable peace comes from knowing that we actually depend on each other. We don't, any one of us, have a big enough lever to change geopolitics, right? But we're talking in our, in our context, in our neighborhood, what are some things that we could do? Use your own sense of comfort for, whether you want to disclose anything here, but, sort of think yourself into that relationship that, that is not particularly peaceful, either because there's, there's open conflict in that relationship, or because you just would really rather not with each other. What would it look like for you to invest in interdependency in that relationship, to put yourself in a position that actually needs that other person? Because if you can put yourself in a position where you actually need the other person, then you have enough sort of internal initiative to actually, stay in that relationship, even though it's difficult. What would you need to put yourself dependent on them?
The old American habit of taking a new neighbor's a plate of cookies would start. Yeah. Now, I don't necessarily dislike these new neighbors, but it's a place to start. It's a extending a hand.
Right. And what you're doing there is you are... you're offering them the opportunity to be in your debt, right?
That's not the way I think about it, because I don't expect them to be in my debt.
Right. It's a debt that's never going to get paid.
Yeah, in the sense that they might be less likely to come at me with an axe tomorrow morning. I suppose I'm in their debt, but that's not the way I choose to think about it.
So we have about 30 cars parked on our street every school day. Not this year, because they're doing hybrid in Urbandale, so half the kids means everybody gets parking space. A lot of the neighbors have been angry at the kids for the way they park, how close to the mailbox they are, we can't get our mail delivered, all kinds of issues that you can come up with. And I said, where are they supposed to park? There's not parking at the high school. No matter how much our taxes are paying for that new school, they don't have enough parking spaces. Kids drive alone. The school promotes carpooling, but it isn't happening. And the mailman said, or the post worker said, why don't I just deliver their mail at the end of my shift instead of the beginning, which is after 4 o'clock. So we now get our mail around 5 and the cars are all gone and everything's fine. And a lot more neighbors are beginning to say, oh, okay, it's all right. And they start looking out for kids, like telling the kids, look, the police have come by 3 times. Don't be too close to the mailbox. Make sure you're away from the driveway. I even told a child one day that they could park in our parking in our driveway because there just wasn't enough room. And I could see he was trying to squeeze into a spot he shouldn't squeeze into. So those kids that were irritating, you can start looking out for them and helping them figure things out in life. Pretty easily.
It might add to the story that because I have a brother-in-law who is a mail carrier, I've discussed this kind of thing with him. And his going out of the way to deliver the mail off the normal route, which is much more planned than you might imagine. They have a lot of people with apparently with big brains, who sit around and map out the most efficient way to deliver the mail. But if that mailman is actually doing that, that's coming out of his own pocket.
Yeah, so so he's solving a problem for Deb and her neighbors in a way that allows them to, because they're not bearing quite as much of a cost. Every time I talk about somebody, they disappear. So Deb and her neighbors are not bearing as much of a cost for having the high school students park on their street. And so they can kind of afford to welcome those high schoolers back into their circle of, we can, you know, we can extend extra compassion to these people. So
now I have to make cookies for the mail provider too.
Perfect. So there's your assignment for the week before we come back and do our 21-day equity challenge. Your assignment is to go seed some interdependency in your neighborhood. Go create some of those non-zero-sum relationships. Continue to take John seriously on the fact that in order to do that, you've got to do something that won't get paid back. Because if you, if you actually place your neighbor in your debt, they're going to resent that, right? So the only way to make your neighbor happy enough to like you is to give them a plate of cookies without a bill attached. Right? That's the difference between a neighbor and Amazon. And so go plant some of those seeds of interdependence in your neighborhood.
I'll go to the example that, again, with my neighbor who mowed our lawn or part of it a while back. It took us a long time to figure out who had done that. He had no expectation of return.
Right. And because he didn't have any expectation of return, you really want to do something nice for him, mm-hmm. right?
Beyond just not calling the police.
Beyond not calling the police beyond when he has a party. So you're going to go and plant some seeds in your neighborhood this week particularly for the people you don't like, right? Or the people that you've got those sticky relationships with. Because those are the people where if you're gonna build that peace, what you need is you need to need them and they need to need you in your neighborhood and in your relationship web. So, and again, like define neighbor in the way that you most need to. Like if I just said that person you don't like and the person you don't like happens to live somewhere else, do something nice for them. But those eight neighbors are still a really big place to start and work on that.
Thank you for listening. Learn more about our mission at wdmcovenant.org.